Toward the One, the perfection of love, harmony, and beauty, the only being united with all the illuminated souls who form the embodiment of the Master, the Spirit of Guidance. My subject this afternoon is Paths to God. And there is a well-known saying among the Sufis that there are as many paths to God as there are breaths. Every breath is another path to the divine. But there are, one might say, superhighways, paths with many lanes. And this afternoon, I would like to describe some of these superhighways, the ones that the Sufis considered especially important to their own work. And of these, particularly five. And these five are known as the pillars of faith. These five paths have their exoteric dimension and their esoteric dimension. These paths are called, in Arabic, Shahada, Salat, Saum, Zakat, and Hajj. So we begin with the first, which is Shahada, which means witnessing, bearing witness. And it begins with our original act of bearing witness in pre-eternity, prior to incarnation, on the day that is called the day of Alastu. That was the day, it is said, that God summoned all beings ever destined to become, called them forth, and called them to the divine presence, and posed a question. Alastu bi rabbikum. Am I not your Rabb? That word Rabb is a word that is impossible to translate in English in a single word. Most often, it is translated as Lord. But when we think of the word Lord, we think of all kinds of associations with medieval dictatorships, associations that have nothing really to do with the etymology of the word Rabb. The word Rabb is found in tarbiyah, is found in the word cultivation, education, bringing up, raising a garden, raising children, nourishing, fostering, caring for. That is what is implied by this word. So God speaks and says, am I not your creator, sustainer, judge, and forgiver? Am I not your Rabb? Am I not the paradigm, the archetype, of which you are the exemplar? Am I not being itself, the unity of being? All of this is included in the question, Alastu bi rabbikum, am I not your Rabb? And the soul, your soul, my soul, standing there before the truth, answered without wavering, Bala. Yes, I attest it. That was the original yes. That was the motive force that propelled us into being, into manifestation. The original yes, I will declare it. I remember once in Delhi meeting with a very venerable Sufi named Khwaja Hassan Sani Nizami. His father knew my grandfather. He's an elderly man now, and when I met him, he had suffered a heart attack, and I asked him about his health. And he said, this was my second heart attack. My first heart attack was on the day of Alastu. My first heart attack was on the day when I was asked, am I not your Rab? That was the first heart attack, when my being was shattered in the profundity of the covenant that it implied. It was an earth-shaking moment. It shattered the heart and propelled the spirit through the planes of existence toward manifestation. It is that yes, that bala, that affirmation that has engendered this cosmos, that empowered the Big Bang, the primal flaring forth. It was that yes that cooled the galaxies, that stimulated the emergence of life on planet Earth, that has guided the evolution of species. It is that yes that has directed everything that has happened up until this point, leading to this present moment for its fulfillment. We came with a mandate. We have made ourselves at home, but we are guests. And we are guests who have been brought into this domain for a purpose. A purpose is ultimately a very simple one. It is to attest, it is to bear witness. To bear witness in the Rab, and to say at every level of one's being, with one's tongue, with one's mind, with one's heart, and with one's spirit, to say the kalma-i shahadat, the word of witnessing, La ilaha illallah. La ilaha illallah. That is the fulfillment of the mandate of pre-eternity. To see everywhere unity, to see everywhere Allah, to say no illah except Allah. To say, La mawjood illallah, nothing exists but Allah. To say, La maqsood illallah, there is nothing to be pursued, nothing to be sought but Allah. La mahboob illallah, no beloved but the one reality itself, the Rabb, the essence of every being. This is the attestation. This is the act of bearing witness. To remember what one has forgotten. One came here to join in the throng of the created world, to be one among many, but among the many, to continuously remember and testify to the One. When we say La ilaha illallah, we say there is no worshipped object, there's no posited existence except Allah. What is Allah? If we are attesting to the singularity and absoluteness of Allah, what is Allah? Allah is a word. What is the origin of the word? In Arabic, Allah is spelled Aleph, Lam, Lam, Ha. And you know that in Arabic, Aleph, Lam is the definite article. It means the. Like in Spanish, El, the. When the Lam is doubled, it means the only. So we've accounted for the first three letters, Aleph, Lam, Lam, the only. Then we get to the climax, the only what? What letter is left? The only breath. The breath of all breaths. The source from which our life's breath has come, and the absolute current into which it will return. None exists separately, independently, autonomously of that one eternal breath. That is the first path, the path of shahada, the path of continuous remembrance. As Sayyid Abu Hashim Madani said, on this path there is only one virtue and one sin. The virtue is the breath that is breathed in awareness of the unity of being, and the sin is the breath that is allowed to escape in negligence, forgetfulness. That is the totality of morality. That is the deepest morality, beyond all conventions and codes of etiquette and law. It all comes down to this. Virtue, all virtuous action, comes out of a degree of awareness of unity, of seeing in the other the essence of one's own self, seeing that one essence as being identical. That is the source of all goodness. What is the source of all that is awry, all that is needlessly destructive? It is the opposite. The simple forgetfulness of unity. It's the simplest practice, and yet it is the most effective and necessary one. To remember in each breath, in each instant of time, La ilaha illallah. Nothing but the one breath. Once we knew this, we knew it well. As infants, as small children, we didn't divide up the world into segments, but we saw all as one, and we saw ourselves as no different from the world. If you held up a mirror, the infant would not see the reflection as being any more proper to himself or herself than any other object. Everything seen is self. That was the seamless state that we once knew, the oceanic unity. In our development as individuals, we've learned to delineate, to discriminate. And at the level of manifestation at which we exist, this capacity is a part of our natural and necessary evolution. It's only when this development proceeds at the expense of, in forgetfulness of, the more essential mode of knowing, that it overtakes everything, and all one sees are the parts, the fragments. One no longer sees the whole. It is then that we have straight, and it is then that we have need of the simplicity of the child. And that is why Bayazid Bastami said, the Sufi is the infant in the bosom of God. A state of awakening is a state in which we reintegrate that lost innocence, that simple, sincere perception of the unity of all being. That is what we reawaken in the practice of Shahada, the practice of continuously returning to this single phrase and beyond the words. The words might be recited in any language. The subtle realization, the innermost thought, unity, unity on every breath. So let us pause here before proceeding to the next path. Take a moment for introspection. Close the eyes and turn within. We must admit that our perception of the world is conditioned by our cognitive habits. We've learned to look at things in a certain way. For convenience, we jump to conclusions. We see a certain outline of a figure, and suddenly in our mind, the fully formed figure emerges. We are always looking for delineations, contours, in order to identify parts, and so even as you close your eyes, you'll find that the fragments of your perception persist, fleeting images, notions, ideas. And notice how each of these fragments assumes the singularity of the object. When we look around the room, we imagine that we are seeing people, seeing objects. But what is a person? What is an object? Looking more closely, you will see that it is a confluence of qualities. And the same qualities that make up each object, exist outside of that object. And what is unique in an object is simply the particular combination and proportion of qualities embodied temporarily in that object. But ultimately, an object emerges out of the qualities and then deteriorates and resolves into the qualities. No object, no person in its distinct formation is permanent. But the qualities themselves, that is what we really see when we see a person. Do you see a person? No. You see the qualities that happen to converge and present themselves. And yet you imagine that you're seeing something distinct, something separate, a person. That person is nothing but a temporary placeholder without absolute being. And so if one shifts focus, one sees that what endures are qualities. Those qualities flow continuously, pulsing through all fibers of the cosmos, not dependent on any one configuration. And then you see that the person, the object, etc., was just like a mirror. And the whole world is just like a palace of mirrors. The Mughal emperors used to make palaces of mirrors, embedded walls and pillars embedded with mirrors at every conceivable angle, so that images were projected endlessly, distorted and rearranged, expanded and diminished. What we are seeing is the qualities of reality reflected endlessly in objects, but the objects are just empty placeholders. Now the qualities themselves, if we look more deeply, are just refractions of one single light. Just as if you would pass a beam of light through a prism, the range of colors would be revealed. So the range of qualities is just the spectrum of colors inherent in one single light. So that single light refracts and reflects endlessly throughout this palace of mirrors. And yet when we see a thing, we fixate on the object, we fixate on the mirror, thinking it is permanent, thinking it is real. It's nothing. It's a phantasmagoria. It's a show, a dazzling spectacle, revealing the essence of that one single light that reveals itself in all places. And the whole of the universe then is a single mirror, in which the totality of reality is fully reflected. And your consciousness itself is a mirror. And your consciousness is a mirror that is held up to the mirror of the universe. Your consciousness is capable of reflecting any quality in existence, whether near or far. In principle, the entirety of the cosmos is capable of being reflected in the mirror of your consciousness. And yet yourself is just as empty as any object. There is just one light that reflects endlessly, in which nothing is separable from anything else. Everything is intimately interconnected with everything else. It is all the recursive interplay of a single luminous essence. You do not exist. But your glance is the glance of the one being, the one light, looking upon its own countenance. So as you open your eyes, see that the light that you see is the same light that sees itself through your glance. Every face in this room, another facet in the hall of mirrors, in which one light endlessly reflects. Now we come to the second pillar, Salat, prayer, glorification. And there are many modes of prayer. There is the ritual of prayer. There is a ritual of prayer that is particular to each revealed faith. And there is a providence in the form, an elegance to the rhythm. In fulfilling a certain routine of prayer, one is brought closer and closer to the path of remembrance. By arriving each day, or several times a day, at a certain place, at a certain time, with a certain intention, there is tremendous empowerment on the spiritual path. The Sufis explained this, saying that when a person stands in prayer, the angels who are flying overhead take notice. And the next day they will come again at that same time, in that same place, to see who is there. And if you are there again, fulfilling your prayer, they will come again and again, and you will be joined in your prayer by the angels. That is why having a rhythm of prayer, a routine that is maintained, is extremely powerful. One concentrates one's spiritual energy, creates a sacred space, and in that space, a conversation opens. It is a conversation between the lover and the beloved. Ultimately, it is the only conversation that ever exists. Every conversation is a part of that conversation. But here, in that moment of prayer, you are making that one conversation conscious, sincere, intimate. That is the meaning of a regular rhythm of prayer. You are dying for your ideal if you bow down, saying, "I die for thee." And as you are lifted up, you declare, "I live for thee." One rededicates oneself to one's shahada with the whole of one's body. Every cell of the body participates in the prayer. What is most important, though, is the intention underlying the prayer. It is quite possible to go through the motions, and yet the thought is elsewhere. There's still some benefit even in going through the motions if the thought is elsewhere. And yet the full benefit cannot be obtained. What is most precious is the intention to join the heart with the beloved is the most beautiful of intentions, and it is felt. The story is told that there was a man who heard the call to prayer and was rushing off to finish up his business so that he could make his way to the mosque. But by the time he arrived, he saw people coming out. And he asked someone, And the man said, yes, the prayer is finished, you missed it. And he was so saddened that he let out a sigh. Like that. And when the man who was coming out of the mosque heard that sigh, he said, let me trade with you. You take the virtue of the prayer that I've just performed, and I will take your sigh. And afterward, he readily agreed, of course. He was happy to have the benefit of that prayer. But then, going home that night, he had a dream, and in that dream, the Prophet appeared and said, you made a bad bargain. What was most important was the desire behind the prayer, that sigh, that longing for the intimacy of the prayer. That was the essence of the prayer. And that is a feeling that can arise not only in the moment of going through the ritual of a prayer, but particularly when one has established the ritual, it arises spontaneously at all moments, sometimes unexpectedly. In this sense, prayer is just the galvanizing of the natural feeling of the heart, and it can happen at any time. We always have thoughts of gratitude, thoughts of repentance, thoughts of supplication, thoughts of invocation, and even a feeling of communion. But these are just impulses that are lost in the chatter of our inner dialogue in the course of the day, unless we seize upon the opportunity and feel that here is a moment for prayer. If there's a feeling of appreciation for something, uphold that appreciation as an act of prayer. Lift one's gratitude high. If there's a feeling of guilt, don't just let it fester as guilt. Lift it up as a prayer of repentance, acknowledging one's fault, acknowledging the confusion from which that fault has come, and then reaffirming the clarity beyond the confusion, the clarity of one's soul's true innocence, making amends and moving on. To take each of these common emotions that occur throughout the day and spiritualizing them, dedicating them to God consciously, that is the meaning of prayer. If you see an ambulance driving by, not only to think, I feel sorry for the person inside, but to lift up a prayer of well-wishing, sending your sympathetic resonance, your solidarity with the one who is in trouble. That is taking a common feeling and giving it wings. And that is why it is said that prayer engenders angels. In fact, prayer is the most creative of acts. Prayer is pure creativity. There's nothing more creative than prayer. What is created? Oneself is recreated. The world is recreated in prayer. The heart is a receptacle. The word in Arabic for the heart is qalb, which means a mold. It can contain something. It's a cup into which something can be poured. But a mold has a certain form, and so the heart can receive only that which fits its form. That form, the form of the heart, is the form of the God ideal, the form of all that is most meaningful to you. That is the form of your heart, the form of your ideal. What does reality look like to you in its perfection? That is the God ideal. And your heart molds itself to receive that form. Each religious dispensation has helped to mold the heart in a certain form, to receive a certain epiphany, to receive a certain grace from the source, in proportion to the capacity of the heart. And as the heart grows in prayer, in actively receiving that which is given, its form changes, its form expands and softens, its contours shift, and progressively it becomes capable of grander, deeper, fuller, vaster forms. One begins with a literal and simple idea of the truth of reality. But if there is sincerity, that simple idea suffices. It fills the heart, and the heart of its own accord will grow and change to accommodate vaster and vaster dispensations. And so the Sufis have always had tremendous respect for the ways of all faiths, understanding that each faith had given a form of belief that sufficed for the believer in that particular moment. And it was considered by the Sufis unacceptable to criticize the belief of another. And yet in one's own development, there comes a time to leave behind the belief, the quality of belief that has become outgrown, so that the heart remains not only calcified in one single rigid form, but is able to accommodate, to embrace further and further dispensations. As Shaykh al-Akbar Muhyiddin ibn al-Arabi has said, "Beware of confining yourself to a single belief and denying all else, for much good will elude you. Indeed, the knowledge of reality would elude you. Be in yourself a substance for all forms of belief, for God is too vast and tremendous to be restricted to one form rather than another." This is learned in prayer. This is learned in developing a real relationship with God. It comes about when one's relationship with God becomes as important as any relationship. It's ironic, isn't it, that although we might believe in God in the sense of the totality of being, we realize there is some power greater than ourselves from which we have come and to which we will return. And yet we cannot say that we have a personal, meaningful relationship with that being to the degree that we have a relationship with the people in our lives. This is a relationship that's more permanent. This is a relationship that is more essential, and yet it is the relationship that is usually considered least. But it is not separate from the relationships that we have with the people in our lives. It is implicit in them. فَإِنَّمَا تَوَلُّ فَثُمَّ وَجْهُ اللَّهِ. Wheresoever you turn, with whomever you are relating, there is the face of God. Psychologists speak of transference as the tendency to carry over the impressions of one relationship into the next relationship, so that you begin to think about your wife in the same way that you thought about your mother. Well, the Sufis accept this, but take it further. They say that all relationships are based on the transference from one single relationship, that relationship that was established on the day of Alastu Birabbikum. Every relationship is the elaboration of that one relationship when we said, Bala, yes, I will affirm it. Everything that we do to everyone in our life, we do to God. And everything that we receive from God. This becomes conscious in prayer. And when we pray, we are refashioning the heart to receive the fullest possible dispensation. Our God ideal is something that we extract from our lives assiduously, quietly, surreptitiously. No one knows this is happening. We ourselves might not be fully aware, but we are doing this. At every moment, we're looking for the beauty. We're looking for the majesty. We're looking for all of the qualities of perfection in our life, in our relationships, in nature. And from every scene, from every episode, we distill something. We take it in. All that conforms to our picture of perfection, we take it in secretly and lodge it deeply in the heart, in the perfumed sanctuary that is inviolable. We're jealous of this ideal. We don't want to speak of it openly, to let it be subjected to the insensitive criticisms of those who will not understand. We have an inner life, a secret life, where we store away all that is most precious, and we are building something there. We are building an idol. Al-illah al-makhluq fil-itqadat. We are building an illah that is created in our belief. We are creating a god in the heart, just as a honeybee creates honey, flying from flower to flower, taking the pollen, digesting it, assimilating it, drawing forth its sweetness. That is the process of prayer, which culminates in the construction of a God ideal that is elaborated, that is ornamented, that is decorated, that is given all of the most fitting qualities that we can imagine. But what is the process whereby we create this ideal? It is in prayer, when we visualize, when we evoke what is perfect, what is great. But how do we evoke it? How does a painter paint a portrait? To paint a portrait, you have to get into the attunement of your subject. You have to feel the emotion of the countenance that you are portraying. So that means you have to stimulate those qualities of being in yourself. The pigments that you use to paint the canvas are nothing other than the latent qualities within yourself. You have nothing else with which to paint. And so you must evoke all the perfection in oneself that remains as yet unmanifest. So it was that the great Renaissance painter, Fra Angelico, when he would paint the scene of the crucifixion, he did so weeping, with tears in his eyes, he painted. And if you go and see the paintings of Fra Angelico, you can see he has captured something that could only come out of the depth of his own feeling. It's so palpable because he has brought it forth from his own being. That is the truth of prayer. It is from this that the God ideal is created. from the deepest reservoirs of your own self. And so it is that prayer is the most creative act, because in praying to this perfection, you must portray this perfection. To portray it, you must realize it in yourself, and so you are recreated. God, in calling forth from you prayer, is calling forth from you the sifat Allah, the divine qualities that need integrating, that need manifesting in this embodied sphere. That is the meaning of the path of prayer. And it leads ultimately to a climax when the idol that one is so assiduously crafting can no longer support the intensity of divine presence that is coming through, and it shatters.